Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year after the controversial bailout of the auto industry, there are signs of life from Detroit. Profitability, new jobs, and rising car sales. Nobody is tooting Detroit's horn louder than the president, but polls show skeptical taxpayers are impatient to see a return on those billions. And uncertainty remains over whether car makers are on the road to sustained recovery. This hour On Point, checking the vitals of America's auto industry, 1 year after the big bailout. You can join the conversation. Did you buy an American car this year? What drove that decision? Price? Cash for clunkers? Maybe something else? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll hear later this hour from Ron Blum, the president's car czar. But first, joining me now from Detroit, Michigan, is Michelle Krebs. She is senior analyst and editor-at-large for Edmunds Auto Observer and has covered the auto industry for over 25 years. You can find a link to her column for Edmunds' Inside Line at our website, onpointradio.org. Michelle Krebs, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
And joining me from New York City is Paul Ingracia. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning automotive journalist and author of the new book, Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. Paul, thank you for being here. Paul, are you there? All right, we'll try to get Paul on the line. Michelle, let me start with you. 1 year after the bailout, are we seeing a real turnaround in the auto industry?
Well, we're a far cry from where we were a year ago. A year ago, it looked like we might lose two automakers. Today, they're alive and I won't say fully well, but recovering. So we've come a long way.
So give us some numbers. Sales. Are sales up with the big three automakers?
Well, actually, this July, they were up. All three of the Detroit automakers, Chrysler, Ford, and GM, were up 5% each. In contrast, Toyota and Honda were down. Nissan was way, way up. But we are seeing a turnaround. There's some new product out there. The big three actually are doing well because they have the new product. And it's kind of an interesting turn of the tables because in the past, it's been the Japanese who have had the very quick life cycles for new vehicles, constantly introducing new ones. They aren't introducing as many right now, and it's the big three that are, Ford in particular. And it's almost always the case that you got the newest product, you're going to win for that moment in time.
So up 5% each, was that expected? Is that about right for where we are now?
Well, it's not great, let's put it that way. We have expected a very rocky ride here with the recovery of the auto industry, just like the economy. It's a total reflection of that. We had expected July to be a little stronger than it was. And, you know, we're talking about an 11.3 million year for car sales. That's about a million better than last year, but it's a far cry from where we were a few years ago when the U.S. sold 17 million.
Paul Ingracia, do we have you now in New York?
Yes, Jane.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you, Paul.
Tell us how
the numbers speak to you. Do you see a real turnaround? Is this premature to call this a comeback for the auto industry at this moment?
I don't think it's premature to call it a comeback. It is premature to call it victory, though. And that's been Detroit's historic problem, honestly, Jane. In years past, ever since, let's say, 1970, when they would have crises, they'd mount a recovery and then sort of assume everything was fixed. And frankly, it wasn't fixed. So they have a ways to go. But I think what is encouraging here is that despite the Despite the very mediocre sales numbers that Michelle has cited, all three of the Detroit companies are actually profitable, especially Ford, but the other two are right around break-even. So it's encouraging, but the battle is never over. Let's put it that way.
Here's President Obama last Friday giving a pep talk to workers at Chrysler's Jefferson North Assembly Plant. He said that they were proving the naysayers who were against the auto industry bailout wrong.
I wish they were standing here today. I wish they could see what I'm seeing in this plant and talk to the workers who are here taking pride in building a world-class vehicle. I don't think they'd be willing to look you in the eye and say that you were a bad investment.
Michelle Krebs, where do you think we would be without the $60 billion rescue package?
Well, we wouldn't have Chrysler and General Motors, I think. I think that the bailout was absolutely necessary, especially where we were at that time in the economy. I just don't think the economy could have withstood the demise of one or two auto companies. And, you know, there's about eight other jobs that are related to the auto industry job. So it would have been devastating. So I think Paul has said this well. You just hold your nose and do it. And it's done now, so let's move on.
Paul, what about actual jobs lost in the last year or two within the industry? What are the numbers?
Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics put out some numbers a couple weeks ago that said that in the year prior to the bailout, the U.S. auto industry, that's not just GM, Ford, and Chrysler, of course, it's a lot of companies make cars here, lost 355,000 jobs. In the year since, the U.S. auto industry has added 50,000 jobs back. So let's call it a net of 300,000 jobs lost over the last couple years. But of course, in the years leading up to this crisis, there were a lot of other jobs lost too. So it's a, you know, the employment picture has not been good. But as Michelle said, you know, the a lot of jobs in this economy depend on the automobile industry, and it's not just jobs in Detroit. It's dealers in Texas and Wyoming and the accountants that service that, you know, that handle the books of the dealers in Texas and Wyoming, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a real ripple effect. This bailout was not we shouldn't have done it because General Motors and Chrysler deserved it. They certainly did not deserve it. But we as a country deserve to be protected from an economic crisis tipping over into a catastrophe.
Of those over 300,000 jobs that you say were lost, how many have been recovered, Paul?
Well, as I said, the BLS said 355,000 jobs were lost in 50,000, you know, in the year before the bailout. In the year since, 50,000 jobs have been added. So,
okay,
that's the math.
So those numbers aren't that terrific, Michelle? Huh?
No, and some of those jobs are lost forever. Productivity has really improved. The other thing that Paul kind of touched on is we're seeing a shift in where the jobs are going. We have Hyundai and Kia, Korean automakers, building plants in the South. Mercedes is expanding its plant in Alabama to include C-class car production. We're seeing Volkswagen's building a plant in Tennessee, a number of plants in Tennessee by other automakers. So there's a shift in where the jobs are as well.
What about the underlying health and strength of GM and Ford and Chrysler, Michelle? Are they strong generally? Is the long-term health of those companies dependent on consumers still buying more cars?
I think the long-term help is dependent on a couple of things. Consumers getting back into the market again, and that's what's been worrisome. We are seeing consumers only tiptoe back into the auto market when they absolutely have to buy a vehicle. The other thing I think that there cannot be a complacency, like Paul mentioned. They cannot go back to their old ways. I mean, they're certainly healthier because the bankruptcy wiped out the debt of GM and Chrysler. Ford's still saddled with a lot, but I'm not convinced it's insurmountable. But can't fall into old ways.
What about that important piece of this puzzle, Paul Ingrassia, consumers actually getting back into the market?
Well, it's going to be slow, it looks like, but again, the good thing is they're making money at a relatively depressed level of sales. Now, no one expects us to go from 11.5 million sales this year back to the bubble years of 17 million sales, at least not anytime soon. But as Ron Blum, I'm sure, will point out later in this program when he's on, If these companies, if the U.S. economy gets to a point where car sales recover halfway, 13, 14, maybe even 15 million, these companies are going to be making a lot of money if they keep their current cost structures intact.
And let's remember, too, they've also, GM and Chrysler got a nice deal from the United Auto Workers Union that new jobs created will be at a lesser pay than the current jobs. So that also helps the bottom line.
Well, I'm not sure. That's a good point you mentioned about the UAW, Michelle. I'm not sure that the two-tier wages, the new lower wage tier, really is the answer or the solution or the panacea. And the reason is that, you know, the Korean and the Japanese and the German factories here don't have two-tier wages. They pay the premium wage level. The real issue on the labor front is work rules and attitudes, basically. You know, it's these restrictive job classifications that says if a machine breaks down, and Michelle is standing right there and she knows how to fix it, she can't do it because that's Jane's job and you got to wait for Jane to get off her lunch break.
Right.
And there's a lot of that stuff still in there, and that's the problem.
What about Toyota in all this? How much did Toyota's troubles play into the rebound of the American industry? Michelle?
Well, I would certainly say that that has helped Ford in particular. You know, Ford also benefited from the other two taking government money. We heard that over and over. Plus, they had good product. You can't deny that. But certainly, you know, Toyota's troubles caused buyers to look elsewhere for vehicles. And frankly, I think Hyundai was one of the bigger beneficiaries of Toyota's problems.
How do you see it, Paul?
Well, I agree about Ford and especially Hyundai. The remarkable thing is there's so many ironies between Toyota's troubles and the troubles of the old General Motors. One of those ironies was that Toyota, whatever the safety issues are, it's undeniable that the quality of the company's cars started a market deterioration around the middle years of the past decade, 2005, 2006, and that's because the company tried to expand very rapidly to overtake General Motors as the world's largest automaker in terms of production volume, and it emphasized quantity over quality. The other irony is that just as General Motors was in denial for so many years that, you know, they never believed at GM they could actually go bankrupt, Toyota, when these reports started coming in and the statistics came in that said their car quality had declined, was also in denial. They'd been the quality leader for so long, they could never believe that their cars were not as good as they used to be.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the health of the U.S. auto industry this hour, 1 year after the controversial bailout. We're joined this hour by Michelle Krebs, senior analyst and editor-at-large for Edmunds Auto Observer and a veteran industry reporter. Also with me is Paul Ingrassia. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning automotive journalist and author of the book Crash Course, The American Automobiles Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. Pick up where you were left off, Paul, before we had to go to break there. You were talking about the quality and the marked deterioration of the quality of American cars, say, 2005, 2006, and you were making a broader point.
Well, yeah, it was really the Toyota cars that I was actually specifically talking about. In the year 2005, Toyota actually recalled more cars in the United States than it sold that year. And so basically when all this sudden unintended acceleration stuff started to surface late last year and this year and all the furor over that, in a way it was a shock, but the truth is, you know, the bottom of all what's happened there has not been really fully revealed yet because the government's still investigating, et cetera. But the deterioration in Toyota's quality over the last 5 or 6 years has been undeniable, and right now Ford, according to Consumer Reports, actually has higher quality than Toyota.
Michelle, what do you make of that?
Well, I think there's been some interesting analogies. I mean, I think Toyota looks a lot like General Motors did in terms of there wasn't this culture of you raised issues with the boss, you told the boss what you wanted to hear, you know, the emperor wears no clothes, but nobody will tell him. I think they got into the same kind of situation that GM did some time ago, and the bureaucracy. They're also this global company that is spread out all over, and there's terrible communication between the various branches. So I think in the end, if Toyota learns lessons from this, just as GM and Chrysler should learn lessons from their latest journey, they could be a much stronger company.
Here is Daryl Izzell. He's worked for Chrysler for 15 years, installing doors on the Grand Cherokee. He was interviewed by NPR last week in Detroit, and he credits the government's rescue package for actually saving his job.
Nothing like presidential leadership to step in and handle a very contentious situation that was the situation here in Detroit. I appreciate it. I mean, I owe my job to him, basically. We all owe our job to him. Morale is very high now compared to what it was this time last year. It was kind of bleak, but got a good positive product. That's the main thing. Hopefully we can get some more shifts going on in here and return to prosperity and profitability.
Paul Ingracia, generally speaking, who are the winners, who are the losers 1 year after the bailout?
Well, certainly the companies that are still alive that would not be otherwise alive without the bailout, General Motors and Chrysler. Some of their workers retained their jobs, some didn't. Some managers and executives lost their jobs, some stayed on the job. So really, in any given group of people, there are some winners and some losers. Some dealers were terminated, some dealers were retained. But by and large, there are certainly more winners than there would have been if these companies had been simply collapsed and been liquidated.
The other person that that worker needs to be thanking is Fiat CEO Sergio Marchionne, because without Fiat, Chrysler probably wouldn't be around, even with the bailout. And he has been a very incredible leader and helped Chrysler a lot.
Paul, you see that? Fiat is a savior a bit here?
Well, absolutely. The Obama administration, don't forget, on April 1st of 2009, when President Obama went on television and said, look, you know, both these companies might have to go into bankruptcy, and Chrysler and GM are in different situations. Chrysler really can't needs a partner to survive, as he put it, and the only partner that was willing to come forward was Fiat. Nobody else wanted to touch Chrysler.
Here's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org, posted by Richard, who says, after all the bailouts for General Motors to release the Volt now for $41,000 with a $17,000 federal subsidy seems like a recipe for failure to me. I would not buy a Volt at that price and might not buy one at any price, and I'd really like to buy an American car. Let's turn to the Volt for a minute, and General Motors' big new all-electric vehicle. How do you see this one playing out, Michelle?
Well, it's certainly a very important vehicle for GM in terms of image, but I think there are other vehicles that are even more important in terms of bottom line and volume. The Chevy Cruze, which comes out this fall, it looks like it's going to be a terrific small car, which is something none of the big three have done well at in the past, and they've got to make money at it. They're making it in the United States at the Lordstown, Ohio plant. So that is just as important. But image-wise, Volt is important to show that GM is a technological leader. Now, interestingly, the Volt has a $350 a month lease price, which, you know, that high sticker price looks like big, but when you get the lease price, it isn't that bad.
What do you think about the price point, Paul Ingracia?
Well, a couple things. First of all, just as Michelle, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the Volt's not all electric.
It's a hybrid,
right? Yeah, it is a gasoline.
Well, it's not exactly a hybrid either. It has a gasoline engine that produces energy to power the electric motor, but it runs on the electric motor all the time, sometimes alone or powered by the gasoline engine.
I just wanted to clarify, there's a gas engine in there.
Yeah, it has a gas engine.
Okay.
But the point is that I think whatever the price point is, this car has to have a demonstrable advantage over other hybrids and other high-tech cars out on the market, and that's not clear yet. The other thing is that distresses me, to be honest with you, is why are we giving people tax subsidies to buy this car or to buy Fiskars or to buy anything else? I mean, honestly, we have to stop being bailout nation at some point.
Well, that would be fine, Paul, if we had gas prices that would encourage people to buy smaller, fuel-efficient or alternative fuel vehicles. But we have gas prices that just don't encourage that kind of buying behavior at the moment.
Well, it's true, but I still see no justification at all for giving away taxpayers' dollars to subsidize these things.
Does it suggest to you, Paul, that perhaps America is not ready to embrace this kind of a vehicle?
Well, there are only three times in the history of the U.S. auto industry in which people have moved from big cars to small cars. One was 1973. the Arab oil embargo. One was 1979, the Iranian oil crisis, and then 2008 when, you know, gasoline got above $4 a gallon. So unless, I think Michelle's got a good point, unless the gasoline prices get high, people are just not going to do this. And, you know, the politically courageous thing to do, frankly it won't happen, would be to raise prices on gasoline through taxing gasoline simultaneously to lower income taxes. That way you're taxing consumption and not taxing production. I don't think it'll happen.
It won't happen.
Right.
Paul, you're writing a book about how cars have helped shape American culture. And before we have to let you go here in a couple of minutes, I'm curious how you would say the latest chapter in our country's history, the government bailout of the U.S. auto industry, how has that shaped our story?
Well, it's going to be – there's a lot of resentment out there, I think. And it's not entirely a bad thing, the resentment of this bailout. So because it was a – it was – something we never should have had to do. This was a disaster that was not made in the global economy. This is a disaster that really occurred because of bad union and bad management decisions and bad union management relationships in Detroit that just got out of hand over many, many decades. The combination of a corporate oligopoly and union monopoly, and the result was a disaster.
Well, Paul Ingrassia, thank you very much for your time, sir. I'm appreciative.
Thank you, Jane.
Paul Ingrassia joined me from New York City, Pulitzer Prize-winning automotive journalist and author of Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. Let's get to the phones. Michelle Krebs, as you're sticking with me here, Pete is on the line from Urbandale, Iowa. Hi, Pete. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
You know, this is not a car for the masses.
The Volt.
$1,000.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. It sounds like an elitist-type product. Until they start restoring the middle class and start increasing the wages in the bottom of the rung, who's going to buy these cars except a very few elitists? You know, someday this $41,000 car is going to sell for $5,000 at a used car lot. But in the meantime, we're not addressing the problem.
Pete, thank you. Michelle Krebs, why is it so expensive? Is it the technology?
Well, first of all, Pete raises a point that we discuss a lot in our office, and that is the issues with the middle class. It doesn't just apply to the Volt. It applies to the entire auto industry. If you don't have a vibrant middle class, who's going to buy cars at all? You know, whenever you have a new technology like the Volt, a lot of money's been put into it, and GM is trying to get some of its money back. It's yet to be seen if they'll make money on it. The Toyota Prius is another example. It's not clear that Toyota made money when it introduced that. When you introduce a new technology, sometimes you just have to eat some of the cost or offset it with a higher price.
Mm. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is Ron Blum, known as the Car Czar. He is the senior advisor to the U.S. Treasury for Automobiles and Manufacturing. He helped lead the administration's auto task force, which orchestrated the American auto company bailout. Ron Blum, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here. Jane, how are you?
Well, I'm well, thank you. Tell me how 1 year after the bailout, President Obama seems to be feeling quite good about this $60 billion rescue of the industry.
Well, I think the answer is we are feeling good. We're feeling cautiously optimistic. We want to be thoughtful. We don't want to overstate. But I do think if you look at the situation the year before the bankruptcies and you look at the situation in the last year, I think there are some very positive signs. In the year before the bankruptcies, the industry shed 334,000 jobs. In the year since, it's gained 55,000 jobs. Both of the companies, I think, show good positive signs of turning around. Again, I want to state it cautiously, but we do feel that the industry is in a much, much better position because of the difficult and tough decisions the president made, but the assistance he offered. And so, yes, I think this is a time to sit back a minute and reflect and to be positive.
I asked our analysts earlier, I'll ask you, how do you view the underlying general health now of General Motors and Chrysler and even Ford?
Well, look, we view them all, three of them, as very significantly better than they were a year ago. Now, that you could say that's a low bar. A year ago, General Motors and Ford were General Motors and Chrysler went into bankruptcy, and Ford was in a lot of trouble. but what we do view them as better, and we view them as better for a couple of different reasons. One, we view them as better because all of the companies have been restructured. Ford was able to do it without a bankruptcy, but Ford did a lot of very hard work to get sacrifices from its stakeholders, which we think is very positive. And General Motors and Chrysler, obviously, with our assistance, made real changes in their financial structure. But also, I think, you do see a difference in attitude from all of the three companies. I think you see three companies much more focused on the consumer, moving much more quickly to make decisions, much more oriented to forward and long-term thinking. So I think the other thing that is really noteworthy, and while we believe we were enablers of those change, we don't take credit for those change. In fact, we think those changes were made by the companies, by their stakeholders, by their union, by their management, by the board of directors, and one of the things the president wanted to say last week and I think wants to say today to these folks is congratulations. You are doing good and important work, and so we do view the changes as positive in both those respects.
Ron Boone, let me ask you about a new report by a government watchdog group, which is quite critical of the government's handling of car dealers during the industry bailout. They say that when the government told General Motors and Chrysler to quickly close many dealerships as part of the government-led bankruptcies, that those decisions led to potentially adding tens of thousands of workers to the unemployment rolls without really considering the broader economic impact. If you had to do it again, would you have closed as many of the dealerships as you did?
Well, good question, and let me make a couple of points there. First, we did not close dealers. I want to clarify this matter because it has gotten some publicity, and I want to be clear on the role we played and the role we didn't play. General Motors and Chrysler came forward in the middle of February with restructuring plans. And in the end of March, we rejected those restructuring plans and said to the companies, you're not being aggressive enough. You are not being conservative enough. You are not being thoughtful enough in terms of reducing costs across the board. And did that include dealers? It did include dealers, but it in no respect singled out dealers. We also told them to take a tougher look at their factory footprint. We told them to take a tougher look at their relationship with their employees and their retirees and their creditors. And what we said to these companies is, you got to do this more aggressively, because if we're going to recommend to the president that he commit taxpayer dollars, you've got to be more aggressive in your restructuring. And in that and when they got that from us and came back and gave us revised plans, they did include more quickly closing dealers than they had initially talked about doing. By the way, they did not, in fact, close any more dealers over time. They simply agreed that they needed to do it more quickly. But that the same was true of factories, the same was true of other creditor reductions, the same was true across the board. Now, were those reductions very painful for the affected people? Of course they were, and they were terrible. But you have to pose them against the alternative. What was the alternative? The alternative was either, one, we do nothing. And so half of our critics who say it's terrible you didn't care about the dealers wanted us to let the companies fail entirely and have every dealer go out of business. So I think those critics honestly don't have much voice in this debate. So I don't think it's a practical answer to say, did some people lose their jobs? Yes, they did, and it was terrible. One alternative was to do nothing, let the companies fail, and have a million people lose their job. The other alternative would have been to let the companies continue to run up enormous bills and to write them blank checks and to give them everything they ask for without demanding tough-minded change. And I think that's equally irresponsible. Did the President of the United States commit $60 billion of taxpayer money under his watch to this project? Yes, he did. But if we'd met every demand and said to the company, nobody can get hurt at all, nobody has to make sacrifice, it could have easily been a multiple of that. So were we quite concerned about the employment impact on dealers? Absolutely, as we were on employees, as we were on creditors. Many of the bonds by GM were owned by retired people. But the reality is these companies had gotten themselves insolvent. And unless you're prepared to ask everybody, all stakeholders, to come together with shared sacrifice, I don't think you can legitimately ask taxpayers to put in resources.
Well, Ron Blum, thank you very much. President Obama's car czar joining me from Washington. I appreciate your time, Ron. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about U.S. car manufacturers and if taxpayers are beginning to see a return on last year's big bailout. We're joined this hour by Michelle Krebs, editor-at-large for Edmunds Auto Observer. She's been covering the auto industry for over 25 years. And joining me now from Versailles, Kentucky, is Jack Kane. He's owner of Jack Kane Ford, which is a dealership that serves central Kentucky. He was a guest on this program in 2008. Jack Kane, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Hello, Jane. It's certainly good to be back, and good that we're talking about better things today.
Well, tell me how things are going. How have things been for you over the last year?
Since the cash for clunkers, I guess July and August last year, our business and the car business of Central Kentucky has just been on a gradual uphill climb. And today, I've just had a meeting with several car dealers this week, and to a man and a lady, they were all smiling and doing a lot better.
So cash for clunkers was good for you. What's moving on your lot right now? What's hot? What's not? What are buyers looking for? What's their attitude? What are they saying to you when they come through the door?
First thing they say to us, believe it or not, is that we've never looked at a Ford before, but we're here because you all didn't take the money. Mm-hmm. That starts out half of the conversations we have and getting a lot of new customers that way. They're buying the upper echelon of our cars, the Taurus, the Edge, Fusion, Explorer, and we got quite a few coming to get the Explorer now since the Explorer is going to change this fall. The 2011 makes it a bit smaller, and so they love the Explorer, and so they're coming in to get that.
Mm. As you well know, hundreds of car dealerships have closed in the last couple of years. Have you seen the effects of this where you are? Oh, do you have dealer friends who've had to close up shop?
Absolutely, and I think that's the worst thing that could have happened, closing these dealerships. Thousands of people here in Kentucky have lost their jobs from dealerships that were making money and needed to be there to serve their customers. I think it's the worst tragedy that the car business has had in the 50 years that I've been in business.
So you were on this program, as I mentioned, in 2008. Back then, you told Tom Ashbrook that you were in favor, I believe, of a government bailout. Looking back over these last couple of years now, hearing what you're hearing from your customers, what do you think? Was it the right move?
I think so. Philosophically, I'm against that. I'm a great believer of survival of the fittest. But by golly, with the way Detroit was looking and the way everything was then, we were going to lose a lot of our domestic manufacturers, and they would have been taken over by who knows. And I think it's really saved Detroit and that area. It's also saved the suppliers that helped Ford Motor Company. Ford could not have kept all those suppliers by themselves. They needed Chrysler and GM to stay in business. So looking back, I think it was a good move.
Well, stick with us here for a minute. Jack, let me get some callers into the conversation with
yes,
Michelle
ma'am.
Krebs, who's also with us. Nathan is on the line from Burlington, Vermont. I know you've been waiting for a while, Nathan. Thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sitting in my Ford pickup at a job site now. I'm a carpenter, and I have a problem that I think is a microcosm for America's problem of American pride, the jobless recovery, and perception. My problem is this. I'm looking at a new truck right now. I can either go between Ford, which I've always bought, and I want to echo those thoughts of the previous guest you had from Kentucky. I do take a lot of pride in having a Ford, and they didn't take bailout money. But in the world of trucks, where I do find that it's the American worker is helping the American worker, I can't give my money to Ford. Their trucks are made in Canada and in Mexico from foreign parts, and where Toyota makes most of their trucks here in the United States through American-made parts. And so it's that perception of what is an American company anymore.
Hmm. Well, most of our trucks are made right here in Louisville, Kentucky, just about an hour's drive from where my business is. I don't know where you got the idea that all of them are made overseas. They are not. The great majority are made right here.
Nathan?
I could stand corrected, but a lot of the research I've done on the internet through the Ford website itself, a lot of
look at the Louisville truck plant, Mason, and you'll find that that really is it, and that's key. And plus, we sell a lot of trucks in Canada. It is a good plant, and of course, being so close to Detroit, it makes good neighbors for us.
Michelle Krebs, could you shed some light on this?
I would love to jump in. What kind of Ford truck do you have, Nathan?
A 150.
Okay. Well, I think this, you raise an interesting question. I mean, and that's not, it isn't limited to the Detroit automakers. Everybody uses the same suppliers that build parts all over the place. And I think there is a big question about what is truly American made. But a Ford truck is about as, American as you can get, an F-150.
All right, Nathan. Well, good luck. I hope you find something there. Ralph is calling from Indianola, Iowa. Hi, Ralph. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, folks. Thanks for On Point, and thanks for the topic and expertise. I'm calling to bring Consumer Reports into this discussion.
Okay.
They have several decades of automotive testing experience. There are test results in almost every issue, but they devote their April issue to automobiles. It's packed with a great deal of information on vehicles from all of the manufacturers, so I can only pick on a couple of little areas here. First one is a box that is titled Best and Worst Values. Under the Best column, every vehicle is foreign. Honda, Toyota, Volkswagen, Subaru. Every vehicle except one in the Worst column is American brand, Jeep, Ford, Hummer, Cadillac, Dodge, more Jeeps, GMC, and another Ford. Under a Best Cars under $20,000 column, right at the top of the list, because it's alphabetical, is the Ford Focus. But all of the rest, the 10 remaining, are all foreign. Honda, Hyundai, Mazda, Nissan, Scion, Subaru, Suzuki.
And so, Ralph, what do you make of it, and what are you driving?
I'm driving two Honda Civics and a Geo Prism, which is a Toyota Corolla by any other name.
I think he could be biased because J.D. Power, and I'm not arguing with Consumer Reports, because lately Ford's got some real great things due to their certainly improved quality and the product knowledge that Alan Mulally has really instilled in Ford Motor Company people. J.D. Power listed Ford and the GM and Chrysler in some of the top categories. We're not, maybe the perception is that the American or domestic product isn't all the way back yet, but they're making some great headway, and I'm really proud to represent the American products and especially Ford.
Michelle Krebs, speak to the quality issue as Ralph recites Consumer Reports.
Well, and Consumer Reports took Toyota off its most recommended list after all of its problems, by the way. I think, one of the biggest problems. There are some very good American-built cars. And by the way, most of the vehicles, even the foreign brand ones, are built in America. But it's what's happened in Detroit. It's not been across the board. The newer products are far better quality than the predecessors. I think you can argue the same that Toyotas aren't as good as they used to be. As Paul talked about, they've had problems since 2005 that are just now coming to a head. So there's this inconsistency, and then there's also this perception. I'm always amazed when I read my mail and people are talking about their bad experience with American cars, even back into the 1980s. Well, things have changed a little bit since then.
A couple of comments from our website, onpointradio.org. Here's from Alex. He says, the strong competition from the Japanese, the Germans, and the Koreans is still here. While Ford has a few recent decent vehicles, the cars from those companies are getting better as well. The American companies had better figure out something fast, or they are liable to be in trouble again soon. Here's Christopher also saying, I personally will never buy a Chrysler or a GM product ever again. I've owned two businesses and continue to work for a small business. No one offers to bail me out if I make poor business decisions. These companies should have failed, and the market should have been allowed to run its course. Back to the phones. More listener comments from Dave in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Dave. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to tell you you're doing a fine job filling in for Tom.
Thank you.
I just had a pretty much just a quick question, I guess. why isn't more being done to fuel, speaking of fuel, electric cars, you know, other forms of modes of transportation? We've got all of these companies taking, you know, taking the money and running with it, so to speak, but we're still allowing them to build internal combustion engines. I know it appears that they're doing as much as they can with hybrid vehicles and things like that. But the bottom line is this country and the world in general is, you know, completely addicted to oil. And with any addiction, you can't step it down. You have to cut it off. And you can't just continue to, you know, feed it slowly. The only way I see us getting off of oil, you know, you look at what happens in the Gulf, you look at, you know, our constant need for more fuel. We need to be making more. I mean, we across the board, we should be demanding that all, you know, automakers make hybrid vehicles or electric run vehicles, you know, primarily. And there's not enough being done in that field. And I was just wondering if there was something that the government could have done or should have done at that point, if we were going to give them money to say, you know, you
to enhance that process. Yeah, I hear it, Dave. Thank you for the call from Omaha. Michelle Krebs, how do you respond?
I'd
we talked
love
a little
to take
bit about the
one.
Volt, but go ahead.
Here's the problem. All the automakers are working on electric cars, hybrid cars. The fact of the matter is they do not sell. Hmm. Hybrid cars represent, at best, when gas prices are the highest, maybe 3% of the market. Generally, it's less than that. How do you force the American consumer to buy something just because you've dictated that it should be made and, you know, the auto companies make it? I think that'll be the real test of the Nissan Leaf, which is an all-electric car coming out this year, and the Chevy Volt. And then we go back to what Paul said about the subsidies. He thinks no government subsidy should occur. But the fact of the matter, we have these low gas prices. You can look at a graph, and the only time small car sales and hybrid car sales go up are when gas prices go up. So there's just a disconnect there. And a lot of people are saying the government has to do more to help spur this young industry along and provide subsidies. But you have people like the caller who are opposed to that.
Well, I think due to the fact the government is mandating higher gas mileage figures, I think by 25 we got to get somewhere near average 35 miles per gallon. That is making the internal combustion engine greener. You're getting a lot less bad things in the air as a result of it. And I agree with you. We cannot sell these cars to all people. There's a segment, the green people, tree huggers, they love this, but there's not enough of them to keep us going.
Well, and also you've got cold climates where these don't always work very well, or you have rural environments where are you going to you can't just plug this in anywhere. There's an infrastructure. We're in a chicken and egg kind of situation.
Yeah, what we have, you take a state like Kentucky that is somewhat remote in some areas of the mountains. If you were up here with your Leaf or your Volt or a Ford Electric, who's going to take care of the car for you to get electrocuted? We've heard all kinds of things on call-in shows here. And they've got a long way to go before we go more electric.
The other thing that you raised is the internal combustion engine is getting better and better and amazing fuel economy. If you look at the Hyundai Sonata, a mid-sized car, it only came with a very high fuel efficiency four-cylinder engine in the initial launch, whereas in the past that they would have added a V6 engine. We're seeing, you know, V8s only being in trucks. We're seeing huge improvements in internal combustion engines.
Yeah, the Explorer I'm driving gets about 20 miles per gallon. The 11 is going to get over 31 miles per gallon. Our new Fiesta, which is out right now, gets over 41 miles per gallon. It is reaching those heights that where it's going to be harder and harder to get away from the internal combustion engine.
With just a couple of minutes left here, I'm curious, both of you, how you would respond to the question about the culture of Detroit, 1 year after the bailout, how the culture of Detroit has changed. Ron Blum, the administration's car czar, talked about a difference in attitude, especially in the leadership and the executives of these automakers. Do you see that, Michelle? Do you see that really changing?
I will reserve judgment on that. I do think we've seen a shift in attitude in Ford. Their backs were to the wall earlier, and they I think a lot of it has to do with great leadership. Alan Mulally's a great leader at Ford. But I think that's yet to be seen. And the proof will be when the industry is booming again, if it does. Will they fall back into old ways and complacency?
How do you see that?
I don't think they will. I'm fortunate to be on a committee that meets with Alan Mulally and his group. And it has just been a terrific change, complete change in the cultures all the way through the company. It's just a... It's a cheerleading type thing when you go there now, and everybody is so positive, and they don't just promote people because they've been there a long time.
Jack Kane, you're full of optimism there on your car lot at Jack Kane Ford in Versailles, Kentucky. How do you see the future, sir?
I see it as being good. I think we're in an economy that's going to be gradually improving. I think maybe ours right here is improving a little faster than some areas because we might have been lower than some areas. But I look for nothing but good results. They're building better cars. They're advertising, marketing them well. There's a lot of things going for us, and I've never been prouder to be a Ford dealer.
Michelle Krebs, would you temper that optimism some, or how do you see it?
Oh, it's just my nature. I'm cautiously optimistic. I think that the economy will improve. I think it's going to be bumpy. The auto industry will improve. And again, I don't think it's going to be a smooth upward ride, but it should improve.
Michelle, don't you think also that this downturn we had made dealers sell used cars, and the used car market is just up significantly?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen lots of used car sales and much higher used car prices.
Well, yes. Thanks very much to both of you. Interesting hour, good conversation. Michelle Krebs, Senior Analyst, Editor-at-Large for Edmunds Auto Observer. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you, Jane.
And Jack Kane, owner of Jack Kane Ford, serving Central Kentucky, Versailles, Kentucky. Good luck to you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Goodbye.
Goodbye. You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.